16 years and been through a lot together, and hopefully we'll be through a lot more together. Mary invited me here for the opening of this center. Uh-huh. What was it, two years ago. Yeah. And Ajahn Amaro came, and it was very nice because one of the things that I commented on was in a lot of Western Buddhist scenes, there aren't a lot of monastics in that event. I think all four groups of the Buddha's disciples were present, monks, nuns, lay men, and lay women, and so we thought that was a very auspicious opening to Vipassana Santa Cruz, and a lot of fun. Many of you were probably there. So thank you for coming tonight. It's a great pleasure to be here. What I thought we would do tonight, I'll give a little bit of a talk about practice in the Tibetan tradition, and then we can have some time for questions. Some of you may be curious about various things, be curious about even things like monasticism, and so we can have time for some questions. And then I thought to do a meditation that combines a couple of elements of things that we do in our tradition that may be different for you, may not be things that you've experienced before. So that's kind of our idea for tonight. So we've gone full circle because I just arrived back at Vajrapani Institute today, where Mary and I met to lead a 10-day course there starting this coming weekend. So after being a director in the early 90s and then kind of going all over the place, I'm returning as a visiting teacher, and so it just feels like some sort of fortuitous, synchronistic something going on today. So, and I was talking to the assistant director of Vajrapani, and she said, "Oh, I heard you going down to talk at Vipassana Santa Cruz today." And I said, "Yeah, I'm very into this thing that we have in the West these days that's quite unique, that all the different Buddhist traditions coexist. And we're all friends, and we practice together. And it's amazing, because traditionally, of course, in Asia, because of geography and cultural differences, pretty much, you know, with some exceptions, Vietnam had a couple of different lineages of Buddhist traditions, but pretty much, you know, each country had their own lineage of Buddhist teachings, and there wasn't a whole lot of mix and cross-fertilization. And I think we have a wonderful opportunity in the West that we need to take advantage of a lot more than we do, of really sharing our teachings with each other, sharing our knowledge with each other. And I think both Mary Grace and I, you know, have the great good fortune to know so many different teachers who are friends and our own teachers, and really benefit from that. We both studied, you know, we're both very close to Ajahn Amaro, for example, and I consider him one of my teachers, and people from different traditions and teachers and so forth. So it's a way that we're all enriched, I think, and it's a unique circumstance. And I think it's important to kind of get over, sometimes human beings have a tendency to be kind of sectarian and think, oh, you know, this is my trip, that sort of born-again Buddhist thing. And I think, you know, with spiritual maturity, you can kind of get over that and let it go. And it's really nice that we have so many qualified teachers in the West coming up now. So Mary said, you know, talk about practice in your tradition, you know, in a nutshell, in an hour and 15 minutes. And I'm kind of like, oh, what am I going to talk about? But I thought to talk about some of the things that are unique in Tibetan Buddhism in terms of how we practice, how we meditate, and some of the elements that are really important, and then we can have time for questions. One of the things that's quite unique in the Tibetan lineage is a type of meditation that we call analytical meditation. So in this kind of meditation, rather than either focusing on an object and trying to develop your concentration, or as we do in Vipassana meditation, mindfulness of, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the mind, and so forth, we actually use conceptual thought and use an analytical conceptual process to arrive at insights into certain truths that the Buddha taught. And this is quite different. Often when I teach introductory meditation courses, I always ask this question now at the very beginning. How many of you think that the goal of Buddhist meditation is to empty your mind of thoughts? And just about everybody raises their hand. And I say, well, in our tradition, we actually use the conceptual thought process to gain an insight into certain truths about the nature of reality. For example, we do analytical meditation on the reality of impermanence, something that the Buddha said caused us a tremendous amount of suffering is our denial about the fact that everything that's caused will cease and come to an end. And we don't get that. And so when, you know, people die and relationships break up and we lose our job and the stock market crashes, we freak out because we think it should have lasted forever and it's so unfair that it didn't. And the Buddha said, you know what, you guys, this really makes you guys suffer. And this is reality, and just meditate on it, get that realization, get used to it, and you'll suffer less. As we all know, the only reason the Buddha ever taught anything was to reduce suffering. And so he said, you know, gain an insight into the reality of impermanence and you'll suffer less. And that's the point of everything that the Buddha taught. And many other truths about Buddhism. And what we do is engage in this analytical process to arrive at some realization. And then you have that awareness. You know, it's intellectual. And then something happens during the meditation. You go over the analytical process over and over and over again. And then suddenly, boom. You know, it was one teacher, actually, Mary Grace and I were at a teaching with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in 2005, and this one translator, and I've forgotten who it was, but I never forgot what he said. We were sitting listening to this panel of Buddhist teachers talking, and there's this one teacher who was a translator, you know, so he spent his whole life kind of translating sutras and doing this stuff, and he goes, you know, one day I was translating this sutra and suddenly something went below the neck. You know, suddenly it just went below the neck. So this is what we're aiming at in these kinds of analytical meditation. First we use our mind, just like this translator, you know, we use our mind, we use that process, and then something goes below the neck and changes the way that we relate to reality and reduces our suffering, which is the whole point of everything that the Buddha taught. Okay, so this is something quite unique, I think, in the Tibetan tradition. Actually, in metta meditation, in the Vipassana tradition, is similar to that. You know, you're repeating the phrases over and over to sort of kind of engender a certain feeling of loving kindness in you over and over and over again until it goes below the neck, right? You know, may all beings be happy, may all beings be free of suffering. You say it over and over and over again to try and invoke that quality of loving kindness. And we have a lot of meditations like that in the Tibetan tradition to invoke feelings of compassion, for example, and just shift your mind, you know, habituate your mind. The word for meditation in Tibetan comes from the same root for habituate. And that's what we're doing. We're just habituating our minds to a different groove, you know, a different habitual pattern than the former deluded one. You know, we're substituting thoughts of anger and impatience and frustration with thoughts of loving kindness and compassion and so forth. So it's to gain insights into things like, you know, impermanence, the ultimate nature of reality, and also just to shift into mind states that are more beneficial and positive and will give us more peace of mind. The word for delusion in Sanskrit actually means, the definition is anything that destroys your peace of mind. You know, so the reason to overcome these delusions isn't because you'll be good. It's because it'll make you have more peace of mind. You know, so all of these meditations are substituting a more beneficial state of mind. And so that's what we do a lot of in the Tibetan tradition. Now we gain, for these analytical meditations, there are three main realizations that we're trying to invoke. And these are called, in our tradition, the three principal aspects of the path. So there are three kind of groups of realizations that we're trying to invoke with these analytical meditations. And the three principal aspects of the path, I wanted to just talk a little bit about that because that's how our practices are structured, are renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom that directly realizes emptiness. Okay, so I wanted to just explain a little bit what these are and then show how our unique analytical way of meditating really supports these realizations. The first one, renunciation. Really unpopular word, 21st century America. It sort of invokes visions of nuns in the Middle Ages living in cold convents in Northern Europe and eating dried bread, doesn't it? And sort of being like frustrated and renounced and sort of, you know, miserable. And you know, hair shirts and flailing themselves and all of that stuff. So I think it's a terrible word, you know, because that's all it invokes for us. And what it really means is the Tibetan translates definite emergence is the way that this word that's often translated as renunciation, definite emergence from what? From cyclic existence. So it's the mind that wishes to get free of this endless round of uncontrolled rebirth. You know, we're flung by the force of karma and delusion over and over and over again into life after life after life after life. So renunciation has nothing to do with, you know, shaving your head and looking like a weirdo so that every time you go through an airport security, you know, you have to spend an extra 45 minutes because, of course, like, I've got all the bombs strapped to my body. Believe me, I do a lot of international travel and it is no fun anymore. It has nothing to do with that and giving up your, you know, iPods and your SUVs and living in a cold cave. It's a mental state where you've just given up on trying to make it work, you know, trying to get samsara to work, right? And it's what we've been doing since beginningless time. It's just, you know, you're trying to manipulate your external reality and get it to all work out. How many of you, you know, I still do this thing. I'm like, oh, it's a little intense right now, you know, but pretty soon I'll be in that next place and it'll all mellow out. Like, does this sound familiar? You know, pretty soon, you know, I remember even when I moved to Vajrapani, when I met Mary Grace, I was going through this thing of like, oh, it's kind of intense and, you know, this job and this thing, but pretty soon I'll get used to that and I'll sort this thing out and this relationship thing and then it'll be smooth sailing. And we're always, you know, at lasting happiness is always just right around the corner when we get that one little thing sorted out, isn't it? You know, and then we sort that one out, but another one is like sprung out, and then we kind of smooth that one down, and then another one comes springing out, and it's just endless. If we're trying to fix things externally. And Lord Buddha said, you know what? Forget about it. It's like a house of cards. We're trying to get balanced exactly right. And even if we do get it balanced right, you know, we got the perfect job, we've been, you know, madly in love for 45 years, all the grandchildren are behaving, the kids have jobs, you know, the roof doesn't leak. And then what had just happened to your 401k plan last month, you know? You can't make it stay put, even if it seems like it, because why? Because of the reality of impermanence, you know? And Lord Buddha said, forget about it, it's endless. Like a black hole. You put energy into making your external reality work out. You know, it never works. It's infinite. Forget about it. Just forget about it. You know? What's the only thing that we have even some hope of controlling? You know, our mind and our relationship to whatever happens to us. So put your energy there. And that's what renunciation means. It's nothing to do with shaving your head and setting off all the metal detectors in the air. You know, it's nothing to do with any of that stuff. It's a mental shift of just deciding what is best to prioritize in life. You know, getting free of this endless round, because it really is completely endless. This great Tibetan Lama who came, one of the first ones that came to the United States in the late 60s, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I remember reading this one transcript of a talk that he gave to his students, and he said, the first step of the path is giving up hope. They all like freaked out, you know. He said, the first step of the path is hopelessness. And in a way, it's true, you know. And then that gives you infinite hope. Like, give up hope in trying to fix samsara. And then you're free. You're free because, you know, your mind is free of that endless task. And so that's what renunciation really is. And then you don't, whatever you're doing externally doesn't really matter. You know, because then there are plenty of people who give up everything and are still really attached to trying to, you know, get momentary happiness. You know, there are plenty of people dressed in weird outfits with shaved heads that don't have any renunciation at all. You know, it looks pretty good from the outside and everybody goes, ooh, look at them. But inside, you know, it's a mental shift. And then there's plenty of people with two SUVs and whatever and 12 grandchildren that have made that shift. So it's an internal shift. One of my teachers says, samsara is a broken realm. It's just not fixable. And that's what renunciation is. It's just getting that it's not fixable and giving up that kind of hope. Okay? So this is one of the realizations that we try to invoke with these meditations that we do in the Tibetan tradition. So there are a lot of these analytical meditations that we do, meditating on the nature of suffering in samsara. You know, the nature of suffering in the different realms of existence. We meditate on karma, the law of cause and effect, the 12 links of dependent origination. So all of these meditations that we do in the Tibetan tradition are to invoke this giving up hope feeling. You know, so we just, and it's a question of priorities. It's just shifting the priorities so you do the right thing with your life. It's like all those people that get the cancer diagnosis and then they quit their job and sail around the world. Well, we've got the diagnosis. You know, the fact that we were born means that we're going to die. The clock is ticking. You know, tick, tick, tick. It's just a question of time. Are you going to do the right thing with your life or not? You know, just act like one of those people because we have no idea. And then you just notice your priorities shift into doing something that's the most meaningful thing with your life and not procrastinating anymore. You know, so Tibetan Buddhists are always also famous about doing death awareness meditation. This is another one that we do a lot. And that's the reason. It's not to be bummed out. Oh, I'm going to die. It's inevitable. You know, it's not to go around with a long face. It's to liberate yourself from that procrastination that goes, oh, I'll get around to my spiritual practice. You know, pretty soon I'll retire and then I'll do some retreats. It's like, you don't know how much time you have, so we have to do it now. Okay, so all of these kinds of meditations to invoke that feeling, which just, you know, that is liberation. That mind that definitely wants to emerge. You know, that's where freedom is just in giving up thinking that by manipulating reality externally, that's going to be any kind of answer, because it really is endless. It's endless, that thing. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't take care of yourself. It doesn't mean that you're a homeless person on the street. You know, you take care of reality, but just put it into perspective. And don't pin all your hopes on external things. In fact, I just learned this a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's so beautiful. The word in Tibetan, the word that they use for Buddhist, there isn't really a word that translates exactly as Buddhist, but in Tibet, when you're talking about somebody who's following the way of the Buddha and the teachings of the Buddha, they're called a nangpa, which translates as inner being. And I really like that. Like a being who's kind of putting all their hopes on their inner development, an inner being, rather than an outer being who's just trying to fix it all out there. And I thought that was really beautiful, an inner being. You know, really turning inward and trying to find happiness inside rather than outside. Okay, so that's one of the principal aspects of the path, one of the things that we work on in the Tibetan lineage, and there's many meditations that help us kind of invoke that giving up hope feeling, giving up hope. And then the next principal aspect of the path is what's called bodhicitta. It's the Sanskrit word bodhicitta that literally translates as awakening mind. And then the definition in scripture is the wish to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, all conscious beings. So it's this wish to attain the sort of ultimate goal of the spiritual path, to become a Buddha, to become a fully enlightened being, because only when you're a fully enlightened being do you have all the potential and all of the capacity to benefit others, especially mental capacity, omniscient mind. You know, according to the Mahayana scriptures, an omniscient mind and all of the ability to benefit others. So bodhicitta, this wish, this incredible, noble aspiration to complete the path, not just for liberation, not just because you have renunciation. That's the first step, though. Because why on earth would you put in all of the energy to become an enlightened being if you still thought that samsara was a good idea for you, right? So that's why first we have to develop the sense of renunciation to really get, yes, you know, it's a bad idea. Samsara is really a big drag, and it's a bad idea for me. And then guess what? It's an equally a bad idea for everyone else. Because unless you really have true renunciation on your own behalf, no way to develop bodhicitta, which some people describe as renunciation on behalf of others. You know, you want to get them free too. You realize it's hopeless for everyone else. And it's not good enough to just get yourself free and leave everybody struggling, trying to build that house of cards, you know, that tenuous situation. So you're trying to also get them free as well. And this is what bodhicitta is, that wish, that incredible wish to get all other beings free. And then there's meditations to invoke that state of mind as well. It's not like you're either born Mother Teresa or you're hopeless, you know? It's like there are all of these beautiful, beautiful meditations that we do, and it's a big focus for Tibetan Buddhist practice is, you know, like metta, loving kindness. We have a lot of meditations that are very similar to that. We have compassion meditations. We have a meditation that some of you may have learned from different books, Tong Len, it's called Giving and Taking Meditation. And so many meditations to just try and shift that emphasis from ourselves to others. There's a lineage of developing this mind of bodhicitta called equalizing and exchanging self and others. And it's all about really changing that self-absorption. You know, I don't know about you, I was taught my whole life, I remember my father's mantra when I was growing up was, look out for number one. Say, honey, look out for number one because nobody else is going to look out for you. You know, and our culture tells us grasping at things for yourself is the cause of happiness. And it's just a big fat lie. It doesn't work. You know, if it worked, I'd say go for it. But it so doesn't work, does it? You know, think about the times in your life that you've been the happiest. Hasn't it been when you've been doing something to make others happy? You know, hasn't it been those sort of moments that you feel like you've transcended your limited sense of yourself? Isn't it? You know, those times that you were the happiest wasn't when you were grasping after all of that stuff to try and make you happy. You know, it's usually, I was, right before I left to go to New Zealand, I was invited to come and talk at this Waldorf school to the seventh grade class, because apparently the 13-year-old boys in 7th grade were being mean to everybody. And I'm kind of thinking, only in Santa Cruz would they think that that was a problem, that they needed to call in a Buddhist nun? Because 13-year-old boys were, like, being mean? I mean, it's their job description to be mean. You know, 13-year-old boys, like, they're teasing the girls. And I'm like, you really? Like, I don't, you know, whatever. So I go in there, and I'm talking to them about compassion. And they're like, every 13-year-old boy, oh. So ungratifying, you know? But it was interesting because I asked them to do a little meditation. I said, think of when you're reflect on the moments that you have been the happiest in your life, you know, because we're kind of trying to get them to do this exchanging self and other. It's being sneaky. And I said, okay, think about when you were the happiest. We'll do a little like 7.5 minute meditation. And it was so interesting. It surprised even me, you know, and I teach this stuff. All of it was about relationship for them. Even these 13-year-olds, it wasn't about getting that thing for Christmas and when I got the new whatever. I don't even know what they're into anymore, like video game things. That's probably old news. It's probably something else now. But it was all about, like, harmonious relationship and being out in nature and kind of being in the moment. And I said, wow, that's the same thing it is for grown-ups. It's amazing. Like, they would say things like, oh, when my older brother comes home from college and we all go to the airport to meet him and we're all so happy to see him. You know, and I went around and there were about 25 kids in the class and not one of them said it was anything about external stuff. It was all about harmonious relationships. And that was very cool for me. And I said, think about it, guys. You know, what does this tell you? You know, like the Buddha said, you just figure it out for yourself. You know, check. I just say, check when you're the happiest, you know? So a lot of these meditations are to just, that thing that we're taught in our culture, and we just check, and it just doesn't work. It really is about, you know, feeling like your life is worthwhile. It's not about, what's that joke like, you know, whoever dies with the most amount of stuff wins or something. It's like some bumper sticker. You know, it's not like that. Like, who dies with the most peace of mind wins, and who dies with the, having had the most meaningful life wins, is what it really is. So we just check in our lives and start to make those transformations. You know, there's quite a lot of practice before we actually have this, you know, wish to get enlightened for all sentient beings. Like, that's huge. That's really about as all-encompassing as it gets, isn't it? You know, oh, I'll reach the ultimate, you know, goal of the spiritual path for all other sentient beings. And in fact, when we study karma in the Tibetan tradition, there are certain factors that make a karmic act more powerful. And this mind that wishes to get enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings is actually, when you look at all those factors, the most powerful karmic act. Like, if you designed a powerful, positive karmic act, it would be that. And there's nothing that would be more powerful than that. Which is also why it's the only thing that works to get you to be a Buddha, you know, to get you to be fully enlightened. It is the only thing that actually gets you there. It's the only thing powerful enough, and it's the only reason for having it. You know, the only reason for having it is because you really do want to help beings in that way. So we have many, many practices to develop this sense, you know, first working on our loving kindness, then working on our compassion for other beings, and then you keep building up the layers gradually and gradually. You know, loving kindness is defined at, in Tibetan Buddhism, is defined as wishing all beings to be happy. Compassion is defined as wishing all beings to be free from suffering. And then on top of that, you generate a wish, may I be the one to free them from suffering. You know, and then you generate a wish, I'll do it. I'll pull it off. You know, I want this so much that I'll do all the hard work necessary to actually do that and pull it off. Okay, so it develops in stages. Like I said, we're not born, you know, Mother Teresa. I was so fortunate the other day, the day after I arrived back from New Zealand, I was in Boulder teaching, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, great holy bodhisattva, was speaking in Denver, and I got offered a ticket at the last minute. A friend of mine was driving me, and he got a call on his cell phone and looks at me and goes, do you want to see Archbishop Desmond Tutu tonight? And I'm like, what, are you kidding? Yeah, of course I do. So he gives me his ticket, and I go with his friend, who's 6'5" and blind and weighs 300 pounds. So there's like the bald Buddhist nun and the blind guy with his cane, you know, and we're going in, and as we walk in the Denver Convention Center, it's like the Red Sea parting. It was great. We sat there and like cried through the whole thing, and it was just so beautiful. And I think, you know, he's such an amazing being. Maybe he was born that way, but like even Mahatma Gandhi, you know, you read his biography, big process to become who he was. And it's possible for all of us. You know, we shouldn't look at those beings. It's always the same five, isn't it? It's like Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, Holiness the Dalai Lama, like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, you know, who else? Martin Luther King Jr., mm-hmm. You know, and 6.5 billion going in the other direction. You know, five. Go, you know, but we can be like those five that are our big heroes. And we know it. And we want it deep in our hearts, don't we? Because those are the ones we always talk about, these great holy beings. I mean, they're all Mahatmas, you know, those great holy beings. And it's really what we want deep in our hearts. And we can do it. We can do it. It takes hard work. It's about as much hard work as it takes to be able to play a musical instrument really, really well. Isn't it worth it, you know, to become Mahatma Gandhi? You know, I think so. Like, why don't we put our energy into that? Because it's definitely possible. And there are techniques that help us do that. Okay? And then the third realization that we work on with these analytical meditations is wisdom, what we call wisdom. Insight into the ultimate nature of reality, which is a big long story, but basically, in a nutshell, it's just getting an insight that we co-create our reality through our perceptions, which are forced on us by our karma. You know, we think that we're just an innocent victim, and things are just kind of coming at us, and we didn't do anything to create it, and we sort of dodge the really icky stuff and like grasp onto the yummy stuff and just kind of go through life like one of those balls in the pinball machine, like ricocheting around all over the place. And Buddhism teaches, no, you know, we create our reality. What we create through our perceptions, which are forced on us by our karma, and we create what we're experiencing. And I think we've all had moments of that. You know, have you ever had, I remember going to the movies with this friend of mine in the mid-80s, and those of you who are my age might remember this movie, now I've forgotten the name of it. There was this really popular movie at that point. It had Daniel Day-Lewis, and he was in Czechoslovakia during the...
The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Yeah, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. So I'm sitting there with two friends in this movie. I'm transfixed. I think it's amazing, right? I'm like on the edge of my seat with my mouth hanging open. The house lights go up. I turn to my friend to just go, oh my God, that was the most amazing movie. And she says to me, I just don't understand why they have to make movies like that. Two completely different, you know, we experienced two completely different movies, you know? And we do that all the time, don't we? Buddhism says we do that all throughout all levels, you know? There's all of these sort of concentric circles of subjectivity, you know, that we share with other people. And those are examples of where there's kind of no consensual, you know, shared subjectivity at all. And we've all done that with people. Like your favorite person, somebody else thinks is a total jerk and vice versa. And, you know, we just don't have the same perceptions. And Buddhism says there's a reason for that. It's not random. And we can do something about that too. You know, and that's one of the things that really makes us suffer the most, in fact, and is the cause of all of our delusions, that view that thinks that it's just coming at us randomly, and then we do really stupid things to try and get the icky stuff away from us, and even more stupid things to try and grab onto the yummy stuff, you know, and then just keep that ball of samsara rolling, don't we? You know, we do all of these actions, and it's like, oh, here we go again, you know, another rebirth driven by karma and delusion. Let's think, you know, they say it's, you're kind of flung into the next rebirth without control, and I always get this thing of like, off a catapult, just kind of like this, you know, flung into the next rebirth with karma and delusions pushing you. And it's not understanding how we co-create our reality that is the thing that's doing the flinging, you know, that's causing all of those delusions and all of that karma. So we have also analytical meditations in order to actually see directly the ultimate nature of reality, to cut through the root ignorance that is at the root of samsara. Okay, so we have, and then that actually, that realization is quite difficult and leads me to talk about a couple of the other kinds of meditation that we do, which actually support and enhance that realization, which is absolutely non-negotiable if you want to either just be liberated from cyclic existence or you want to attain full enlightenment. Seeing, getting a direct perception of the ultimate nature of reality is absolutely necessary, non-negotiable. Okay, and it depends on developing what's called single-pointed concentration, the ability to concentrate on an object. In the text they say 4 hours without your mind wavering at all on a single object. Can you imagine? I mean, it sounds impossible, doesn't it? But it's possible and it's necessary, you know, with a mind that's fully engaged in an object. And that's the amount of concentration necessary to actually attain that last realization, that realization of the ultimate nature of reality. So one of the things that we do in the Tibetan tradition also is develop that single point of concentration using an object. For example, you can use the breath as an object. What we traditionally do is use a visualized image of a Buddha, so a mental image of an enlightened being. You know, either Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, a lot of you are familiar with, you know, Tara, Chinrezig, Avalokiteshvara, use a visualized image of the Buddha as our object of developing single-pointed concentration, because then we're focusing on a virtuous object. Any object will do. You know, I could meditate on a visualized image of this bell in front of me and develop single-pointed concentration. But what we do is say, if you're visualizing an enlightened being, there's an extra benefit to that, you know, because you're focusing on a naturally virtuous object while you're doing it. So single point of concentration, absolutely necessary to be successful in the analytical meditation that will give us that ultimate, the insight into the ultimate nature of reality. Okay, so we do that. And then to support all of those practices, we have practices for purification of old negative karma and accumulation of merit. So a lot of the things that look a little bit theistic, you know, in Buddhism, because a lot of times people come in and they go, you know, what are all these offerings for? If Buddha's not God, like what's the deal with offerings and the chanting and the incense and all the things that look a little bit theistic? But a lot of these are practices for purification and accumulation of merit. Because if our mind is prepared, then when we actually sit down to do the meditation, the realizations will come. And the analogy that's often given in scripture is, it's like an old vacant lot. You know, you don't go in there and throw down a bunch of seeds and expect it's going to sprout, right? What do? First, you pull out all the weeds and the broken glass and the rocks and get rid of all of that stuff. And then you plow the ground and add a bunch of compost and fertilizer and get it ready. And then when you plant the seeds, there's a chance that something's going to happen. Okay, and the same thing with our minds. By purifying it, which is analogous to pulling out all the weeds and rocks and things like that, you know, and then adding compost and fertilizer, accumulating merit, which is some of these other practices that we do, making offerings, serving others. You know, if you dedicate it towards your spiritual practice, and many of you work in the helping professions, whenever students come and they say, oh, I'm a nurse, you know, I do this, I'm a teacher, I go, for God's sakes, dedicate your merit at the end of every work day, you know, because you're doing incredible things to benefit others. And if you really have the right kind of mindset towards it, it can really be a wonderful practice for accumulating merit, you know, that will enable us to have these realizations of the path. So that's kind of an overview of all the plethora of different practices kind of put into this context of the three fundamental aspects of the path and the realizations that we're trying to invoke and trying to engender. And so now maybe before we do some meditation, maybe you have some questions about different things that I've mentioned or different practices, anything at all? I know that was a lot to kind of blast you with, and you might be like, whoa. So any questions that you have? Yeah,
I'm interested in an example. Maybe you'll do this as the analytical process.
Okay. Yeah. And we can do that. We can do a meditation that has some of those elements. But just to answer your question, for example, I mentioned impermanence before. You know, an analytical meditation on permanence, and that's not the one that I wanted to do. But I'll just kind of give you an outline of how it works. For example, you know, you're sitting, you're watching your breath. And then you think about the gross impermanence of your body. You know, every breath is different. You bring in the air, you exhale the air, constantly changing. And then you go to subtler and subtler levels of your body. You think, wow, the blood is, you know, it seems like my body is static, that it's sitting here for an hour, no big changes. But then you kind of go to subtler and subtler levels and think, wow, the blood is rushing around, carrying the oxygen that I'm breathing. And then on an even subtler level, at the molecular level, cells are being born and dying constantly, and there's constant change. And even at the level of subatomic particles, when you really think about it, what seems solid and static is constant, you know, just this complete flux of change. And then we go outward from our own body, thinking everybody else in the room is like that. And then even go out to inanimate objects, thinking even this floor, which seems so solid and static, same thing going on. And so to see how, for example, you know, a fresh flower, you know, this is an example. It comes up out of the ground, let's say a lily or a daffodil or something, kind of sprouts out of the ground, comes up, there's a bud, and then there's a fresh flower, you know. And it seems to us that the flower, we cut it and put it in a vase on our dining room table, and it seems to us that there's like 4 or 5 days that it's just a fresh flower, and then one day it wilts and it's a dead flower. So it looks to us like it goes like that, like it comes into being, and then it stays, it's static, and then one day it's dead. Whereas, you know, constant change, and then the subtle impermanence adds up to perceivable gross impermanence, you know, and that's the way it is for everything all the time. And getting an insight into that, you know, and then somebody dies or we die, same thing, you know. But Lord Buddha said birth is the only cause of death. You know, because we're born, we have to die, because this subtle impermanence that we don't perceive, that then finally adds up to the gross impermanence that we can perceive. So just kind of getting used to that.
So the meditation itself is spending, say, a certain amount of time just focusing.
Yeah.
In
analyzing, kind of going through the whole thing until at a certain point you get sort of this aha moment, you know, you really get it. Oh my gosh, you know, it just seems like my body is so stable, and sometimes it gets a little trippy, you know, you're like, whoa, it's just, you know, everything is changing all the time, and you really get an insight, and then that's when it goes below the neck. So you use your analytical mind to kind of go through the thought process, and you go, yeah, molecules, yeah, okay, atoms, subatomic particles. And then at a certain point while you're undergoing the analysis that you go through logically, and there's certain outlines, then boom, like something shifts and you sort of get it at a deeper level. And then for us, often what we do in our practice is repeat a similar analytical meditation over and over and over again to really deepen that realization. So it's not just, and this is something that as Westerners we really tend so much to think just intellectual understanding is enough. Because anybody would say, well, yeah, sure, that makes sense. But then you're still, you know, freaking out when you lose something or something changes. And it's just really changing it, you know, at a much, much deeper level than just intellectual understanding. So we use the intellect and the analysis to get just a real internal shift in the way that we approach reality so that we will suffer less, is the whole point. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome. Anything else? Other questions? Yeah.
Would you explain a little more about merit?
Okay. It's merit is basically one Alex Berzin, this friend of mine who's a translator, prefers to translate it as positive potential. So it's sort of spiritual force or spiritual momentum is one way of thinking of it. You know, through your actions to benefit others, through your actions in relation to, you know, good karma, but a better way to think of it would be, you know, getting some kind of spiritual momentum going that will then create the cause for realizations to happen for you. So it sort of like gets you over the hump and allows that realization to happen. And there are many traditional practices that are done to accumulate this positive potential, and things like offerings are one. But in the West, we relate so much more to helping others, you know, to doing service. And this is a wonderful, wonderful way. Actually serving Dharma centers is amazing. You know, here, like I said, 6.5 billion in this direction, and here we are going completely against the stream. So Mary didn't pay me to say this, but anything that you can do to actually, you know, support and cause the Dharma to flourish, because, you know, believe me, being a nun and traveling a lot, people are starving and they have no idea where to go. I spend a lot of time these days in airports, and whenever I'm sitting there alone, so many people come up and they're like, we don't even know what you are, but, you know, you got the secret and we want it. You know, it's just incredible. And they're just pouring out their hearts and they want to know where to go and what to do. And so it's so important to offer an alternative. And that's actually one of the reasons I got ordained. You know, to me it was sort of the most revolutionary act in capitalist, materialist, you know, 21st century America. It's like, oh no, I'll be a walking billboard for a different way to be. So really, really supporting the Dharma and making it flourish is incredible virtue, because you're helping people wake up. So all of these kind of things really create the potential For then, when you meditate, you know, you have that force behind it, that positive potential or that spiritual momentum. So serving others and serving the Dharma are two of the biggest ways to really accumulate that potential. Yeah. There was some... Yeah, you've had some.
I have a question. And I think I'm largely drawn to Buddhism because it seems, anyway, to not require belief, but emphasizes an actual personal experience of reality in the moment.
Yes.
But listening to you speak about it, it seems like that a core belief, if you will, of Buddhism is in reincarnation and cycle of lives. So I guess I'm wondering about that paradox and also whether there are practices that you do that actually help you realize the reality of reincarnation, or if it's something
right,
that just arrive at logic, or like it just has to be.
Yeah. And both things. Like, I think on one level, and a lot of people obviously in the West have this issue. It's, you know, in the classical Buddhist texts, there weren't a lot of meditations to engender a belief in rebirth because it was just part of the culture and it was a given. And, you know, everybody believed in it. And even in Tibetan monasteries, they don't get that this is actually an issue and that we have to address it. But there are, you know, it's like not everybody, it's not a given the way it was in the time of Lord Buddha or in Tibet too. You just kind of grow up believing in rebirth. But I think one of the things that is helpful to do is just, well, one of my teachers, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, said, you know, you just have to think there's a whole lot of evidence that rebirth probably is the case and not one shred of proof that it's not. He goes, you know, if anybody has proof that it's not. But we all have read, you know, these incredible stories of these little kids. I just met this monk in New Zealand, this Tibetan monk in Auckland, this Tonka painter. And he was saying, he was showing me pictures of his village, and he goes, oh, you know, that was my past life parents and sisters. And I'm like, huh? And he goes, oh, I died, he remembered his past life as this little boy in this village that died when he fell off a horse when he was about 7. And then he took rebirth in the same village and really clearly remembered his past life parents and brothers and sisters. So he's got like these two families going on, you know, and he goes, and when he was a little kid, he told his parents that this was who he was in his past life, and they took him there, and he remembered the name of the horse that had since died, and like all of these memories of people in the family who died since then. So he had these two families, and as we're looking through the picture, oh, past life sister, this life sister, past life father, you know, he had these two lives going on. And there's stories like that, like all over the place. So there's that amount of evidence. And then according to Buddhism, consciousness is not a mere epiphenomenon of brain function. You know, we've been sort of brainwashed by Western scientific reductionism. And Buddhism says, no, consciousness is a completely different thing than just the neurotransmitters going and then you die and it's all over. So just, you know, and there is a little bit that has to be taken a little bit on faith because there's no proof really one way or the other. And then another answer to the question, I think whether or not reincarnation or rebirth matters depends on what's your goal of the path. You know, if you're really going for full enlightenment, that's a mini lifetime process. You know, so if you really are setting as your goal something that is not achievable in this life, you know, if you really didn't believe that there were future lives, it would be really hard to wholeheartedly hold that as a goal. So I think that there's ways that, you know, if you have an obstacle with something like that, then you have to change the goal of your practice a little bit. Because if you really are saying, oh, I'm going to become somebody like, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha and be able to benefit all living beings, like it probably ain't going to happen necessarily in one lifetime. So I think there's ways of changing your sights, which is not necessarily a terrible thing. You know, there are many different levels of practicing in Buddhism, and it doesn't mean that you can't do practices that make this life a lot happier. You know, give you peace of mind. I always tell people, you do compassion meditation, it makes this life sweeter, even if this is all there is. And I think sometimes people ask me, oh, if you found out tomorrow that Lord Buddha was wrong and this life is all that there was, would you change your life? And I can honestly say no. You know, I wouldn't do anything different because it just makes this life so much more beautiful and peaceful and loving to do the practices that we do. So I don't know, that was a complicated answer to your question, but I don't think it precludes Buddhist practice. It just means that maybe your goal would be slightly different if you didn't believe that there were future rebirths. But often what we're told to do in Buddhism is if there's some big thing that you kind of just can't get past and it seems like an obstacle, just put it to the side and don't worry about it. Take it out from time to time and re-examine it, but don't let it kind of throw you off, you know, because I think a lot of these things, and we're not supposed to take everything on faith. That would be really stupid. You know, a lot of these ideas we just have to work with over time and then put it to the side. If it feels like it's becoming an obstacle, put it to the side, bring it back, and take a look at it again later on. Yeah. Yes.
In our world, one of the texts that is referred to often about that is the questions of King Melinda.
Mm.
And there's that image in there of lighting one candle from another.
Yeah,
and
I don't know
whether that's used in your world or not, but in that image, the notion of rebirth is like lighting one candle from another. And is it the same flame? Yes. Right. Is it a different flame? Yes.
Yeah.
You know, exactly what is it that's happening? So it's a little less concrete, I think.
Right.
Sometimes a little more accessible as an image for, particularly as we practice and we come to have a deeper sense of what it is that the nature of consciousness is, then that image also begins to make more sense as something that isn't a belief based, but more you're moving at least toward it in terms of your actual experiential understanding.
Yeah, good. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because what goes from life to life in Buddhism is extremely subtle and not at all, you know, again, as Westerners, we're brainwashed into this idea of the soul, right?
Uh-huh.
It's sort of like Casper the ghost is in there and then the guy it gets stuffed into the next body and we think it's like, you know, this happens in the Tibetan tradition. There are these reincarnate lamas and Westerners always expect like the new little baby to be just like their, you know, 85-year-old teacher in this little baby body, and it's going to be like the same being. But according to Buddhism, what goes from life to life is so subtle, very, very subtle consciousness carrying karmic imprints that's changing from moment to moment, you know. And I think, again, we have this really concrete view of, like, you know, what it is that goes into the next body, and it's just this continuum of energy, really, that continues, that doesn't stop at death. And the lighting one can, you know, it's not the same, it's not different, but it's certainly not the Casper the ghost thing, you know, in Buddhism, that we get sometimes, you know, we have resistance about that because that's what we were taught in our culture. And then you go to heaven and everybody looks better and your hair's nice and then nobody fights anymore. And of course we, you know, I mean, a lot of our resistance to that, I think, bleeds over into our resistance to rebirth. But if, like Mary said, if you really study what is the nature of that consciousness that goes from life to life, some of that resistance we have melts away a little bit. So, yeah. Anything?
Part of what, how I think about that is you know, one of our fundamental misapprehensions is this notion of separate self.
Yes. Yeah.
My image for it is almost like it's like a tree, and we're all these little leaves, and we think we're these different things, but we're just part of this tree, right?
Yeah.
And then eventually we're going to fall off, and we'll get composted and go get sucked back up.
Yeah.
And be a different little leaf that, you know, has never really been separate from the tree.
Yeah.
It's part of our fantasy that, you know, this little leaf is different from that. And the karma that kind of pushes us along is some of those imprints that we take with us from one leafness to the next.
Yeah, and it's that wrong view of the self that we think exists that doesn't, that's the root of the, you know, that's the big troublemaker right there. Like, it causes all of those delusions that cause all the karma that drives all that rebirth. So that's the ultimate, that's why they say that's the ignorance that's the root of cyclic existence, is especially the ignorance about the way the self exists. I mean, it's true for everything else too, but especially about the way the self exists. And that's the big insight that you get when you actually have that direct realization into the ultimate nature of reality. It's the reality of the self is the first insight that you get, and then you see how it's true for everything else too. Yeah, I like that analogy. There's a whole section over here that's hiding behind Joe. Aaron's back there hiding.
I can't see the moons of Saturn directly, but with a strong enough telescope, I can. Similarly with the past lives, is there methods for being able to develop the capacity to be able to have a direct perception?
Yes, and in fact, I was just studying this recently, and there's something that's taught about in the Buddhist text called the five divine eyes. And this is developed actually quite relatively early on the path, even before you've had a direct realization of the nature of reality, quite a long way before you develop certain clairvoyances, including the ability to see your past and future lives. So this is sort of no big deal, you know, to have that ability, relatively speaking. I mean, much meditation practice, but these are all of these clairvoyances are actually side effects of developing single-pointed concentration. These are all things that come as a result of developing single-pointed concentration even before insight into the ultimate nature of reality. So there are beings that have had direct realizations of their past, many beings that have had direct realizations of their past and future lives, you know, and then you're not really supposed to go around talking about it a lot because everybody will think you're nuts, but there's plenty of beings who, you know, have had and will sometimes indicate that they remember. Even His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the current one, says, you know, he says modestly, until the age of about 3 or 4, he did have memories of his past lives. And this monk, you know, very ordinary monk, not even a reincarnate lama that I just met in New Zealand, like very matter-of-factly, you know, past life family, this life family, no big deal. So it's not at all uncommon for people to report those kind of direct experiences. Yeah. Anything else? Okay.
I have one more.
Yeah.
I've also been practicing in the Tibetan tradition for a long time. In Tibet, and there's the Shinne and Lapa, Tibetan shamatha vipassana.
Yeah.
So, how does that vipassana relate to this vipassana? Are they two different things, or is one
extension of the other? And I think again in the Tibet, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about vipassana in the Theravada tradition, but my understanding is it's basically using direct observation of the impermanence according to the four foundations of mindfulness, like really actually directly watching that subtle impermanence of the mind, of the body, of the thoughts, and so forth. So it's by direct observation you get that insight rather than that logical train of thought. So that would be it. Instead of using that logic and that whole conceptual analysis the way that we do in the Tibetan tradition, it's same insight is arrived at through observation instead. And the four foundations of mindfulness actually is not emphasized in the Tibetan tradition, but it does exist in the Tibetan tradition. But nowadays, more and more, analytical, you know, logical, rational chains of thought are used to arrive at that same insight. But the insight arrived at, you know, is the same. It's just different techniques of arriving at it, is my understanding. And Mary can probably say more about that.
Vipassana in the Theravada world, there are actually three major areas of insight. So one is impermanence, and one is the nature of suffering, and the last is the nature of self, or not self.
Yeah.
So would you, and all of those can be worked with and seen with working with the foundations of mindfulness. So would you also work with all three of those with analytical meditation as well?
Yeah, definitely. And it's also interesting because the selflessness, I just taught a course in Boulder on the selflessness according to the four philosophical schools, Vaibhashika, South Tantrika, Chittamantra, and Madhyamika. And the selflessness that is seen as the ultimate nature of reality of the different philosophical schools is slightly different. Mm-hmm. So you know, the selflessness that's arrived at according to the Theravada tradition, which would be based on the Vaibhashika school, is somewhat different.
You're sounding like the Dalai Lama now.
But it's interesting because also it helps to study that when we are in this unique situation that we are of, you know, you go to the Zen Center and the Vipassana Center and the Tibetan Center, because I had two students come to that class who live in Pueblo, Colorado, and they go to kind of everything that they possibly can. They're very confused because they were hearing different things about the ultimate nature of reality, and they're thinking that it should be the same. And after that weekend, they were like, this is great, now we get it, you know, because they're talking about different things. We were trying to get it to coincide, and they don't. So I think it's especially important for us in our unique kind of cultural milieu to understand that there are subtle differences mm-hmm. between what's being arrived at in that meditation, just so we won't be confused. Like, we can still partake of everything. I think the confusion comes when we think it should accord. You know, and I teach in this prison in Kolinga in Central California. Of course, the prisons are always in some, like, desolate, horrible place. So they were inviting, and, you know, they kind of see me as their teacher, and they wanted permission because this Taiwanese Zen monk was willing to come in and teach them. And I said, oh, by all means, but just understand this, that what he says about selflessness is going to be from a different philosophical school. And then they wrote to me after he came in going, that was so helpful you said that, because it's true, and we didn't try and make it coincide. And, you know, I gave them a little brief talk about, you know, how it was different, and they said that was helpful. So I think it's important for us, because a lot of confusion comes when you just try and think, oh, all Buddhists are saying exactly the same thing, because there are these subtle differences. Yeah. And that's a long story. Yeah.
One last question. It's not going to take too much time. Yeah. I was reading a little bit before coming here on the Land of Medicine Buddha website about and learned that you had done a 6.5-year retreat.
Yeah.
And besides just being absolutely astonished by that thought, I was wondering if there is such a thing as a typical day in a 6.5-year.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, 6 times 365 was what it was. In our tradition, when we do any retreat, actually, whether it's 6.5 years or a week or a weekend, there's a sort of a traditional way that it's set up in terms of 4 meditation sessions, each of which lasts 2 or 3 hours. And the traditional thing is to wake up early, generally 3:30, and do one before dawn, before sunrise. And of course, it depends on daylight savings time and all of that stuff, but that's the traditional thing. And then you eat a light breakfast and have a little break. And then you have a second session before noon, which is the main meal. And then right after the meal, you usually have a break of an hour or two. And that's when I would do some kind of exercise, go for a walk or do yoga or something. And then an afternoon session before sunset, and then a final evening session after sunset. And so that's what every day was like. And then during the meal breaks, in the evening I didn't eat, in the evening I just had a tea break, and then that was my study break. And we're only generally study the subject that we're meditating on, you know, so you don't take Harry Potter in, you know. you only take books that directly relate to what it is that you're studying, and inspiration, you know, which is like the biography of great yogis, and those moments where you're just like, oh my God, this is too hard, I can't do this anymore. And believe you me, there are more than enough of those in 6.5 years of like, what am I trying to do? I'm just a normal American girl. I must be out of my mind to try and do this. And then you read about the other, you know, yogis that also had a hard time and stuff like that. So that's kind of the typical thing. So each day you're actually sitting practicing between like 10 and 12 hours a day, with basically just breaks for meal preparation and exercise and a little bit of study. So yeah, that's kind of the way it is. I know. But it's sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just one day at a time. You know? It's that thing that you just don't, you kind of don't think. You, in the beginning, I remember, because I actually started out, it was going to be the traditional thing in the Tibetan world is 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, you know? And then I remember the first 9 months or so having many days of like, 2 years, 4 months, you know, 17 days and 82 hours, you know, and then you just totally let go of that and you're like, this is what I do for a living, is just meditate, you know, you just really get over that, when am I going to be free thing, and you just go, this is what I'm doing. And the most amazing thing that I found, and actually Tenzin Palmo, who's this woman who spent 12 years on and off in retreat, and somebody asked her once if she ever got bored, and she just goes, and I can say the same thing, not never, ever was I bored. And she goes, can you imagine if somebody forced you to watch the same sitcom 4 times a day for years? You'd just go out of your mind, like the same Leave It to Beaver rerun, like 4 times a day. But you, everything is always changing so much, and so much like fresh stuff is coming up. I can honestly say I experienced just about every subjective emotion, but boredom was not in there at all. It's kind of amazing, yeah. You know, kind of surprising. So, yeah, that was my... Yes.
In those 6.5 years, it wasn't silent then, was it?
Yes. Yeah, for 3 years I didn't speak at all, and then the next 3 years I changed venues. I went to a different retreat place. And then in that second place, I would have kind of one conversation every 6 months. Something, it was always really interesting. Something would break in my cabin and I'd have to call the caretakers. And I could have gone off and taken a long walk where they fixed the faucet or whatever. But the timing was really interesting. They always, something would happen when I was really stuck in some point of my practice and they'd come over and fix the faucet, and then we'd sit and drink tea for 4 hours, and then it would just unstick me from my stuck place. So I sort of had 1 4-hour conversation every 6 months on average in the second 3 years, and didn't see other people at all, you know. Yeah, because we all, both places were hermitages where other people were doing long retreat, and we had this deal that if you were out walking and you saw somebody else, you'd just turn around and go the opposite direction, so there's no hanging out.
And then most amazing of all, you came to those teachings in Arizona and looked around and saw all those people and went back.
We were blindfolded. We were blindfolded. Really? We didn't see anybody. We were led onto the stage. The first place I did retreat, one of my teachers was doing retreat with us, and he taught twice a year, I think. And we all came out for his teachings, but we were blindfolded and led by someone, so we wouldn't...
No, I'm talking about Arizona when I saw you in Tucson.
Oh, that time. That time. I thought you were talking about... yeah, that's right. Because I had come out...
For a while.
Did I come out for something? Oh, Lama Zopa wanted us to come out for a teaching. That's right. And then... You know, you see 500 of your best friends and go back in. And I actually came out... The first time I came out... I went in to retreat as a layperson. I wasn't a nun. And then I decided to get ordained the third year. And then the fourth year, I went to India to get ordained with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for a month, and then kind of went back into retreat. So, yeah, there were a couple of the last 3 years, there were a couple of things like that in that time in Arizona with His Holiness's teachings. Yeah, so that was... Here I am. Still crazy. What is Paul Simon still crazy after all these years? Okay, so let's do a little meditation. What I wanted to do with you is an example of a different kind of meditation than the ones that I've been explaining. And in the Tibetan tradition, in the Vajrayana, there are specific kinds of meditations that we do. It's the Vajrayana, or the sometimes it's translated the diamond vehicle, is another kind of type of meditation, and we do what we call taking the result into the path. So we actually do practices to invoke enlightened qualities that we say exist within us as potentials and just need to be invoked by certain practices. So in these types of practices, in addition to using conceptual analytical thought, we also use visualization and we use mantra recitation to work on our psyche at different levels, you know. And I think, I always like to think, when I think of the visualization of enlightened beings and doing practices in relation with them, sort of like Jungian psychology, and Mary Grace can correct me on this if I've got it wrong, but we actually, our subconscious kind of speaks to us via images, right? Like when we have dreams, it's not like that movie from the 80s, My Dinner with Andre, blah, 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 right? It's these crazy visual images, and this is sort of the way our subconscious mind communicates with us. So we use this in some of these Vajrayana practices by visualizing enlightened beings and doing certain visualization practices in relation to them to sort of catalyze these enlightened qualities within us that we say exist as potentials, and by doing these practices, we can sort of trigger them, catalyze their awakening. So this is why we do a lot of visualization practices in Tibetan Buddhism also. We also do recitation of mantra, and it's not important to know what these mantras mean. They sort of vibrate energetically in different sort of energy channels in our body. So I thought I'd do just a simple visualization with you so you can get an idea of how this works and how we try and work with the energy of an enlightened being to catalyze some of these enlightened qualities that we're aspiring to. So let's first just sit and watch our breath for a minute or two, just to settle our minds back down again. Now let's visualize in the space in front of us an enlightened being. And you could either visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, or if you have another spiritual teacher that you relate to, or a great saint. Mother Mary, Mahatma Gandhi, St. Francis, Shakyamuni Buddha, whoever it is who for you embodies qualities of compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, the power to benefit other beings. And get a sense of the presence of that being about 2 meters in front of you in midair. If it's hard for you to think of a person, you can just visualize something like a sphere of golden light that embodies all of these qualities. It's just important to think of some person or some image that embodies all of these qualities that you think of an awakened being possessing, having. And then you imagine coming from the heart of that image in front of you, if it's the Buddha or a saint, coming from the heart of that image, a beam of golden light coming towards you. And as you inhale that light, imagine that you're filled with great compassion, the wish for all beings to be free from suffering. As you inhale, continue inhaling the golden light and think, your whole body and mind become completely filled with the energy of great compassion, the wish for all beings to be free from all of their suffering. And as you exhale, exhale in the form of black smoke, any of your obstacles, negative karma, especially in relation to selfishness, self-absorption, lack of compassion for others. Imagine that the minute the black smoke exits your body, it just disappears. So with the inhalation, continue to breathe in the golden light of compassion. Exhale anything that blocks the embodiment of that compassion for you. Any negative karma, obstacles, selfishness. And now continue to breathe in the golden light, and this time the essence of the light is wisdom. The wisdom that sees the ultimate nature of reality, the wisdom that sees subtle impermanence. So your whole body and mind are filled with this wisdom in the form of the golden light. As you exhale, you're exhaling negativities, obstacles, especially ignorance that keeps us trapped in cyclic existence. The ignorance about the nature of reality that causes our suffering. Again, exhale in the form of the black smoke. Continue to breathe in the golden light, and this time the essence of the light is power, to benefit others, the capacity of a fully enlightened being to help others. So as you breathe in this power and this capability, this ability to benefit others. As you exhale, imagine exhaling all of your negativities and obscurations, particularly your ideas about yourself that limit your ability to help others, low self-esteem, doubt about your capacity. You exhale in the form of black smoke. Just take a few minutes breathing in the golden light and imagine that it has all of the qualities of an enlightened being. Compassion, wisdom, power, courage, determination, loving kindness. And imagine that you're completely filled, your entire body and mind transformed with all these qualities, and any remaining obstacles, delusions, negativities eliminated in the form of this black smoke that you exhale. And now we've visualized, done a practice to visualize becoming filled with all the enlightened qualities of the holy being that we visualized in front. At this point, we've attained these qualities mostly at the level of our imagination. That in order to create powerful positive potential, in order to create merit, for this to become a reality for us in the future, to actually be able to awaken these qualities within us, develop them fully, we'll dedicate all of the merit of our evening together towards this goal. So just take a minute to reflect and think all the positive energy from the discussion and the meditation we had tonight towards that goal, developing all the qualities of a fully enlightened being in order to benefit other beings, to free them from their suffering.
So I'd like to thank the Venerable Tenzin Chokyi for her talk and teachings. I'm sure she's available to. And in our tradition here, as is common in all Buddhist traditions, of course, we have a practice of generosity. There are baskets on the, whatever that thing is, shelf in the hallway. One, if you would like to make an offering to Venerable Tenzin, or if anybody wants to offer anything for this, for our Vipassana Center to support our being here, that's also there. So you're welcome, and we invite you to do that.
And I'd also like to mention, there's sort of a cluster of yoginis kind of right here that I know. And for any of the rest of you, I'm doing a 10-day retreat at Vajrapani Institute in the final weekend, which is the... Is it the 7th, 8th, and 9th, I think, not this coming weekend, but the one after, is going to be a silent practice weekend to conclude the 10-day retreat, which is open to other people just coming in for that. So if anybody wants more practice and guided meditations, we're going to start Friday night at 7 and end Sunday at noon of that weekend, and the whole, that final weekend will all be in silence and just many of these guided meditations. So I just thought to mention that in case anybody's curious about more.
Yeah. Okay. And the next one in this series will be Friday, December 5th, and that's with Daijaku Kinst and Shinsu Roberts, who are two Zen teachers, actually relatively new in town, who have a center out on 41st Avenue. So if you'd like to come and hear them, that will be Friday the 5th at 7 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you find out about the silent retreat in terms of, is it,
if there's any Vipassana Santa Cruz being or two who would stay and help put things away, that would be really helpful.
Website, vajrapani.org, and I actually haven't looked recently, but the way we said.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.